Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications is in order. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And this is part two of the discussion that we've been having about our state energy policies and programs and how it's affecting our industry and jobs. And we'll continue on with that conversation first. And we do have a quorum, I believe. We have Andrew Moratska, please, up front. If you could please state your name clearly into the microphone. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, committee members, Andrew Moratska, M-O-R-A-T-Z-K-A. I am an attorney at the law firm of Makel, Crounce & Moore, and I represent large industrial companies throughout the state of Minnesota on energy matters. The typical customer that I represent is a taconite mine, oil refinery, a paper company, pipelines, folks that in their business consume energy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The average annual electric consumption for one of these customers is 500 million kilowatt hours. Okay, and so put that in perspective, the average residential household consumes about 10,000 kilowatt hours. So it's very, very large electric consumption, very, very large gas consumption. As a result, the cost of energy is about 20 to 25% of their overall cost of production. It's something that really impacts their bottom line, and it's something that impacts their decisions as to whether or not they're operating their facilities here or in another state or Canada, South America, China, what have you. If the input costs become too significant, they can and will operate in those other locations, and that can directly impact the number of jobs in this state. In really rough numbers, I think it's a fair estimate to say that my clients employ directly and indirectly around 35,000 Minnesotans. The three topics that I'd like to discuss today that I often hear about from these clients are riders, rate cases, and conservation. Riders are something that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. What they're designed to be a temporary cost recovery mechanism for utilities in between the general rate cases. The problem is that they have become a significant part of the overall bill. Right now, I believe that Xcel Energy, for example, has about 23 of these rate riders. If we look at just two of them, the renewable energy standard rider and the transmission rider, that amounts to about $1 million for an average industrial client. So in addition to your charge and you have the two riders, you have over a year time period about $1 million. Other utilities have similar numbers of riders, and because of the significant amount of money that's being recovered through these riders now, my clients have concerns as to how those charges are allocated among the utility's various customers and ultimately collected. So, for example, if you're collecting these costs of the utility on only a energy basis, only a KWH basis, that significantly impacts large industry more so than your average smaller user. As I said, another topic of concern is rate cases. And I'm just going to bring up one example. And these rate cases are becoming more frequent. They're back-to-back. And in large part, they're being filed because the utility has a lot of capital investments. They have renewable energy mandates, environmental mandates, transmission upgrade mandates. And while I'm not here to argue about the wisdom of those mandates, somebody has to pay for them. And right now, what happens at the commission level is that industry is being forced to bear the brunt of those costs. And we believe that that's entirely unfair. So in the recent Minnesota Power rate case, our clients were assessed with a $39 million increase out of $54 million total. That means that our clients paid 72% of the increase. We believe that's simply unfair. The final topic that I wanted to touch on is conservation. I understand that the committee may be having a SIP day where this will be addressed in greater detail, but I only wanted to point out that because of the significant overall cost, the cost of energy and the overall cost of production, that these customers already have a significant incentive to conserve. If they don't conserve, they can't compete. If they can't compete, they don't operate. So there is plenty of incentive for them to do as much as absolutely possible to conserve energy, and we simply hope that these efforts are recognized and not punished through being forced to participate in SIP programs. So in conclusion, I'm happy to answer any questions. I hope to continue the dialogue. What I'd like to see is a more of an emphasis on cost-based rates and a permanent exemption from the SIP programs for large industrial clients. And with that, I'm happy to field any questions that you may have.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, could you explain how does everybody pay the same rate from the utility companies, or how does that work with the per kilowatt charge and limiting factors or multiplying factors, I should say, when it comes to the heavy users, compared to a business, retail business versus a residential.
Mr. Maraska.
Madam Chair, Senator, the way that the costs are designed in a rate case are based on what's called a class cost of service study. So a utility, when it files a rate case, breaks its customer groups into classes. So you have residential, small business, sometimes municipal or street and lighting, and perhaps large industrial. And based on that class cost of service study, you can figure out what it costs to serve an average member of each class. And that's generally the starting point for taking the utility's overall requested increase and then allocating it among the classes. So you don't end up with a situation where you can really compare, well, this KWH charge is different than this KWH charge, because it all starts back at the cost of service analysis level.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, yeah, I understand that. I'm just saying, just put it in layman's terms, what the cost of kilowatt is, you know, for a residential compared to a retail business operation compared to a large user, just in actual terms of the cost per kilowatt, cents per kilowatt.
Ms. Maratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, the cost is sometimes different, but I put a small caveat in there and note that on there are some customers that aren't billed solely on a kilowatt-hour basis. Some customers also have a what's called a demand charge
right.
put into their bill, and so there is a you can't. It's tough to say again that this person's paying this charge for KWH and this person's paying this when you're not comparing apples to apples.
Senator Howe.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Could you just tell us how many different rates or different ways to figure electricity costs are to the different businesses?
Mr. Muratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not sure I
like
understand the question.
Madam Chair, there are several different utility companies. A lot of people do it differently, but is there 50 different ways to figure an electric cost or the different rate classifications that we have from all across the state of Minnesota? Or are there 100 different rates? Is there 1,000 different rates in our state of Minnesota? Maybe you're not the one to answer that question. I'm not sure, but how many different rates do we apply to different people across our state?
Mr. Muratska.
This is that softball question I was telling you.
Madam Chair, Senator, the rates are, if your utility has five customer classes, there are going to be five different sets of rates, and then any number of riders and other franchise fees, or it's what have you, that are passed through. So each utility has a number of rates, and each utility is a little bit different in how they get there.
Thanks.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How you mentioned, how do we compare with the large energy users with other states and countries? You said that at the onset that it could be a reason that companies would move.
Mm-hmm.
How do we stack up against, first of all, our neighboring states and other countries for the large users?
Mr. Muratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe, and I may be able to defer this question to a later speaker, but I believe that while we may be somewhat competitive nationally, we are less than competitive locally in terms of our neighboring states, and I don't think I can speak to how we compete worldwide.
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, you mentioned that. I thought I got out of it that maybe we weren't competitive with our other in the region, but I think we did remove, except for XL, the personal property taxes on our utilities, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Mr. Fuller?
Are you listening?
I'm sorry, could you repeat it?
I think we removed the personal property taxes on utilities except for XL.
I'm not sure it was only XL, Madam Chair. Senator Metz.
I think they pay a little bit on the Red Wing.
Don't they? Yeah.
They do pay. XL does. But I thought we removed them. Well, look at that. We don't need that right now, but I wondered how that fits into this, because that had to help the utilities. Okay.
Mr. Muratska, my question is this last rate case that you had, which was an increase of 72%. That's not the norm, is it? $39 million out of $54 million. Is this 72%? Is that what you expect when you go into a rate case of having to share that much? Or that must have been – that must have knocked you on your socks. I mean
Madam Chair, the answer to your question would be yes, I was knocked on my socks.
Yeah, but that's tremendous.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Are there further questions? Oh, Senator Anson.
I'm sorry, out of my path here. That's okay. I'm just wondering, Mr. Muratska, so do you know, you said that it's you don't want big customers paying for SIP. Do you have any idea how much SIP big customers use in Minnesota? I mean, how many customers take advantage of SIP and have utilized it fully to try to maximize their energy savings potential? Do you know?
Mr. Muratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, the answer is zero. If the customer is exempt, it can't take SIP funds and doesn't expect to receive SIP funds. So
Who's exempt, Madam Chair?
Senator Anderson.
Tell us who's exempt from taking SIP funds.
I could list out.
Mr. Maratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that the list of exempt customers would include Gerdau Maristeel, St. Paul Park Refinery that is owned by Northern Tier Energy now, the United States Steel Facilities, Taconite Facilities, the Hibbing Taconite and United Taconite Facilities, the Blandin Paper Facility, the what used to be Stora Enso at the time of filing now, New Page Facility, and I think that covers everyone that that we represent.
So, well, Madam Senator Chair, Anderson. Sorry, I'm just trying to figure out what you're saying. They're exempt from getting any SIP services, conservation support from utilities?
Mr. Maratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, the way the statute works is that if you meet a certain threshold, you can petition for an exemption. If you get the exemption, then the sales to that customer aren't counted in the utility's definition of gross energy sales, which means those sales aren't included as part of the overall calculation as to what the conservation amount is supposed to be for that particular utility. So, therefore, the utility doesn't have to worry about having that extra percentage of sales to conserve. They don't spend money on behalf of those customers or assist those customers in conservation efforts because those customers are already spending money of their own to conserve, which is documented in detail in the exemption filings.
Okay, so Madam
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
You're saying that other large users should be exempt beyond the ones you just listed?
Mr. Maratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think that way the statute operates could be amended to include some additional customers. One of the problems that I would point out with the statute is that it focuses only on electricity consumption and not gas consumption, even though the conservation is to be applied to both electricity and gas. So I think it could be broadened slightly, but my big concern is that these customers have to continually come back and re-petition for the exemption, and I think that it would make much more sense both from the customer's perspective as well as the utility's perspective that if you demonstrate that you should be exempt, then that should be it. It shouldn't be there shouldn't have to be additional filings and work that needs to be done to continue it. And as a result, if they are exempt, then they shouldn't get any of the SIP funds either.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
So, if they to demonstrate the showing that they have to make to be exempt is that they're saving a certain amount of energy. Mm-hmm. What exactly is that showing consist of?
Mr. Maratska.
Madam Chair, Senator, the showing consists of broadly two things. One, that you're subject to competitive and economic pressures to keep your cost of production down. And two, that you're making every reasonable effort to pursue and implement cost-effective conservation measures, which those things are detailed in the filing, but they are, even if they didn't need to be detailed, they would be done anyway because, again, these customers are so large and they spend so much on energy per unit of production already that they have to conserve. They have to figure out ways to become more efficient because that's the only way that they can compete globally.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I know that's kind of the economist theory that because you can save money, therefore everyone would do it because of course, you'd do everything you could logically that would save you on your costs. But the problem is people don't do it. And so despite that, that natural incentive that all of us, if we spend a little bit on conservation, we could actually reduce our energy costs, but people just don't do it anyway. And so lots of professors and psychologists and researchers are trying to figure out why and what is standing in the way of that. And I know for businesses that's often been the case. We've heard from some businesses that it's a lack of capital that's prevented them from making those investments. Like in the Rock 10 case in St. Paul, which is something that we kind of lived through their whole evolution in St. Paul, where the company was going to shut down, or likely to shut down after they lost their energy source. There was a whole discussion in the community and in the company and in their whole corporate structure about whether to invest in retrofitting the plant. It was a very expensive plant to run, and we helped them with some, the state helped them do some energy efficiency engineering work and found that they could save 25% of their energy costs. And they hadn't been able to pay for that. They hadn't been able to invest in that. And now they did those improvements and they've saved that energy, and it made them, went from being a very uncompetitive plant to a very competitive plant. And we actually used that model to create the Trillion BTU program, where Xcel is now doing this across Minnesota, across their service territory, to offer revolving funding for businesses that don't have the capital to make those improvements. And they're finding that that's really saving jobs and saving money for companies. But a lot of times they don't make those investments for a variety. There's barriers to that. So I'm just curious if these big energy users have discovered all of those possibilities, and how much energy are they actually saving, do we know? Is that required to be reported?
Mr. Moratzka, that's a very tough figure for you, I'm sure, to come off the top of your head with. And I believe that any business that is looking at the bottom line is absolutely looking at their energy cost, and we'll reach out to all the resources available to them to mitigate and bring down those energy costs and be more conservative. So I still believe in businesses running their own businesses as far as wanting to bring the bottom line dollar or bottom line lower, and that's what they're going to do. They're going to look at everything, but they're, so I don't really buy into what you're saying, Senator Anderson, about they're not going to do it because.
Madam Chair, I'm not making these examples up. I mean, obviously that's what smart business people do. But, I mean, I can give you examples. Rock 10 is one example. J&J Fruit Distributor, that's another. That's a company in St. Paul where they were one of the first companies to use this Trillion BTU program. And the owner of the company said, we didn't have the funds to do these investments. And so this helped them make those investments in energy efficiency that actually allowed them to have more efficient coolers and use, do some building and expansion of the company, et cetera. So maybe we can bring some of those companies in, because there are some companies are able to manage this themselves and some maybe are not wanting to borrow money or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's not feasible for them. So I'm just wondering if the Mr. Moratzka talked about the PUC filings that the large companies had to put in information about what they were doing on energy savings. And it would be really interesting to hear, and maybe you don't have that off the top of your head, but maybe someone else could provide that information for us about how successful they've been at being able to save energy.
Okay. That's a good suggestion. Thank you, Mr. Ratzka. Is there any other questions? We do have a full lineup. Yeah, Senator Dibble.
Oh, thanks. Just more of a statement. I mean, I think if these large energy load users, say that 10 times fast, I would be very interested in that information as well, because it would be interesting to figure out, what kind of innovations, what's going on. I can't even imagine the amount of energy some of these companies up in that neck of the woods I mean, if you've been to some of those plants up there, it's mind-boggling the amount of energy that goes into these manufacturing production that they have. I think it's an interesting idea. You know, if the filing is really a burden, how to at least maintain some awareness of what's going on year over year, or you know, every X number of years, just to make sure that they maintain, you know, if the exemption is well justified and rational. And they're coming up with innovations to the extent that they're not proprietary. Part of the idea in SIP is to deposit a lot of information that the public and businesses can have access to, because people are thinking up stuff all the time. And mm-hmm. so to create this clearinghouse is one of the ideas in the SIP bill that we passed a couple of years ago.
We are going to have a hearing on the conservation improvement program, a full hearing on that, and so we can get into that further. If there's
just one quick, Coke Refinery is contiguous to my district, and there's a few thousand people that work out there that live in Inver Grove, South St. Paul, West St. Paul, and I think they're the largest user of energy in the state of Minnesota. And it surprises me that they've never called me and complained about this. So get them on the phone. No, I don't. But it's just an observation that they think they are the largest. Are they one of your clients? No. Yes or no? That's a tough.
You don't have to answer that.
You don't have to answer that.
You don't.
Privilege information. But you did mention, Madam Chair, three or four clients earlier. So.
No further questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Maratska. I really appreciate you coming.
Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Jay Johnson from Bushel Boy Farms, please. Please state your name clearly, and thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Jay Johnson. I'm the owner of Bushel Boy Farms in Owatonna, Minnesota. We grow tomatoes in greenhouses in Owatonna, and we supply the local stores and restaurants in Minnesota here, and we've been doing it for 21 years. We have 80 full-time employees at Bushel Boy. We operate year-round. And we do buy, which might be interesting, we do buy or use all of our CO2 off of our boilers, our hot water boilers, for the tomato plants. And we also buy many, many semi-loads of liquid CO2 from ethanol plants and the refineries for tomato plants, because they're indoors and they use up all the CO2 and need extra. My concern is we use a lot of electricity for our grow lights in the winter months to lengthen the day so we can produce year-round. We use the latest technologies from Europe and Holland to make them efficient. Both our heat and our lights are the most efficient you can get in our industry. But the main issue is we compete with tomatoes from Mexico, and they don't use or have to use grow lights, and they don't use near as much heat as we do. We are currently, we're on Alliant Energy's power, and we're currently being asked for a 22% rate increase all at one time. This is a very large number for our company, and it comes directly off of our bottom line, because we can't increase our prices because we do compete with Mexican product, and they don't have this same increase. So we are forced to absorb that increase, which greatly affects our business and any possibilities of expansion. And if we'd get more another rate increase like this in the near future, it could force us to downsize or use less lights and or not use as many lights, mm-hmm. and reduce our employment and production. I'm not against renewables. In fact, I think they're great as long as they're competitive and don't increase our rates in Minnesota with other states or other countries, because we do compete and many businesses do compete on a world market. And just because we're in Minnesota, I don't think we should have, or it's it concerns me that we might have a different rate than South Dakota or Mexico, or and make it so we can't compete when we're located in Minnesota. We originally located in Minnesota or Owatonna 21 years ago because of the utility rates. At that time, Owatonna was offering a five-year plan with no demand charge because they had extra energy from the Sherco 3 plant. And that is the reason we located there. That reduced our energy price for the first 5 years by a third. And it really helped, that program really helped the industrial park that we're in. There's many small companies that were started, and a lot of them have turned quite large because they had that incentive with energy that they were promoting at the time. And that's really how we ended up in Minnesota, or Owatonna to be as an employer there. I guess just in closing, when we set, I think it's important that we watch when we do these like renewable mandates, that we know what it's doing to the costs of for our local businesses, and that we don't make ourselves uncompetitive with other states or countries.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. In the past 21 years, how many rate increases have you had?
This is the first one that we've had with Alliant.
It's 22%.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to, the bottom line, it's, have you factored it out, what it's going to do to the business? You mentioned it, you might be non-competitive, but is it, are you out of reach now with the competition?
It changes a lot of things, but we can still make it, but I'm concerned, Madam Chair, I'm concerned that this is only the beginning, because we're not near the 25% renewable mandate or whatever we have to meet.
I understand, too, just in my district, the greenhouses, floral greenhouses, they're all struggling, too, with this issue also. Yeah. Senator Junglar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm always kind of thinking out loud, so while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, what a great deal. You're using CO2, and I don't know if you know the level of that, but I'd like to talk to you, you know, maybe later about your layout, because I'm kind of thinking out loud as we put some of these other programs, the Renewable Development Fund and things. I'm wondering if this might be a good location for a biomass plant where we can actually generate some CO2, generate some electricity to save you some money. I don't know if you have a campus layout type of thing. As Senator Dibble was talking about innovation, when we think about some of the problems and you have another use for that CO2, I think we should look at, you know, is there a way to innovate around that, or are you in such an area that that's just not an option that we can you know, try to look at some other things for you, because we definitely want to keep those power costs down.
Mr. Johnson, Senator Jungbauer is our resident scientist, too.
Okay.
And I love Bushel Boy tomatoes, by the way.
Yes, that's right. Mr. Johnson.
Did you bring a data log?
No. Madam Chair, Senator, our industry for indoor vegetables is based out of the Netherlands, and this is a huge thing over there where they take natural gas fire generators that are range in 2 to 3 megawatts of power each, and the individual growers own them, and they hook them up and they sell the power to the utilities. They take the heat off the engines and heat the greenhouses, and they take the CO2 off of the stacks and put it into the greenhouse. And I think this is an estimate, but a rough number of the Netherlands or Holland's energy, about a third of it comes from the growers over there.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, I'd love to talk to you. Perhaps we can set up an appointment, because that's the kind of innovation I think we're looking for, because it benefits you. And I don't know if you've seen some of the studies that I've gotten to work with a few people, especially Dr. Willie Soon at the Harvard Smithsonian Institute on Astrophysics, on exponential growth increase using pumping CO2 into the greenhouses. And that's one of the things I've advocated, is working on our zoning of greenhouses around some of our power plants and things. And, you know, to the degree we can use any of that and reuse it, I love to reuse water, CO2, whatever we've got that's a waste for one end, we should be reusing it for something else.
Great. Senator Magnus.
I'm all confused now when he talked about astrophysics. That got me all confused about what I was going to ask.
No, Madam Chair Heckwith going to MISO, I think we ought to go to Holland and watch this closed loop system in place. But no, my question.
No, out of state traveling. Talk to your leader. Let's go.
I'm gonna change parties, you guys. Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, I heard you say that you're getting CO2 from ethanol plants. Could you explain a little bit to us about that? How much do you get, and is it, why do you get it from the ethanol plants, from another renewable energy source?
During the winter, Madam Chair, Senator, we're not venting very much because it's so cold out. We have enough CO2 off of the stack of our boilers for what we need. In fact, we're not able to use 100% of it. But during the summer, when the plants are much more active and we're venting a little bit and we're not heating as much, we need to supplement it. So the ethanol plants are saving the CO2 and they turn it into a liquid form, and we buy straight semi-loads of it in a liquid form and then warm it back up with the air and release it in the greenhouses, and the plants take it up through their leaves, turn it to oxygen, and release it. So we buy, in the summer, we'll buy 3, 4, 5 semi-loads a week of liquid CO2.
We like this. This is fun. As an old, Madam Chair, retired agronomist, I like that, too.
Can I comment on one more?
Yeah, Mr. Johnson.
One thing that prevents us from doing our own generator like they do in Holland is the power rate that the utilities will pay us, and we've researched this for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. They only have to pay us their avoided cost, which ends up in the 1.5 cent, maybe not up to 2 cents, and then it doesn't work here in Minnesota. So we could still use the heat, we could use the CO2, but when you're selling electricity, because you want that engine to run as many hours as you can to be efficient, so we can't use all of the electricity, the cost for the electricity that we get back from the utilities makes it so it doesn't cash flow. If there's something we could do about that, the avoided cost.
We'll talk about it.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Johnson. Definitely come and see me because I can show you some things we've done in some other states that are pretty exciting. And I see his XL in the room. They hate me for some of those things we've done in other states. But there's some good ways to do things. And, again, we're all about innovation. We want to make sure Minnesota and the United States is number one. So we've got to work our way past some of these obstacles.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson, for coming up and testifying.
Thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Mr. Glahn. Oh, I'm sorry.
Somebody just want to say I had one of your tomatoes last night for my salad.
I didn't see you, Senator DeBoer.
Sorry.
Mr. Glahn.
Madam Chair,
good to start the day with you and good to end the day with
thank
you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, let me add my vote for the Bushel Boy tomatoes as well. And so my apologies for those of you who heard me this morning. I promise I have mostly new material this afternoon. Madam Chair.
Could you please state your name, though, for
my name is Bill Glahn, G-L-A-H-N. I'm live in Edina, Minnesota, and I'm at present unemployed. So I come before you as a private citizen. But when I was still employed by the state of Minnesota, the last time you took up this subject and I was sitting in the corner, I had a few observations that I wanted to share with you in the hopes it will help the committee with this discussion as they move forward. And my biggest observation is we've heard from a lot of different viewpoints over the two different sessions, and although many of these statements seem contradictory, in fact, everything I've heard over 2 days is true. It's just the nature of the beast here. And the analogy is probably the old parable about the blind man and the elephant. Everybody's observing a different aspect of the same thing, describing it in different ways, but in fact, we're all talking about the elephant. So, for example, renewable energy the renewable energy standard has absolutely created jobs in Minnesota in the renewable energy industry. But does it increase rates to ratepayers above which they would otherwise pay? It probably does. So, those might seem contradictory. It's good for jobs, but it's also has a ratepayer impact. But no, they're both true. So I thought what I would do is, there's a handout where I made some of my notes, but I thought I would try to answer some of the questions that came up from the earlier witness, trying to put some of what I'm going to say later in context. And I'll still try to stay in my allotted time. So the answers to some of the questions that came from this side of the table. And this is from memory, but I looked this up in the last couple of days for a different purpose. But in Minnesota, our industrial rates on average are in the low sixes, 6.1, 6.2 cents a kilowatt hour, which is, you want to say it's competitive. It's lower than the national average. The national average, again, from memory for industrial rates, is about 6.7 cents, or about half a cent lower than the average for the United States in industrial rates. That's not to say that every customer is paying 6.6. If you're a customer of the city of Melrose, you're probably paying considerably less than that. If you're a customer of some other utility, you may be paying considerably more than that. It all depends on your on how you use energy, your load factor, and everything else. But when the Energy Information Administration put together the data as of a couple of years ago, we were paying in the low sixes in industrial rates. And for residential rates, it works out closer to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So, you know, when you hear prices, people talk about grid power, and you can buy power from the MISO grid at 2 or 3 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour. That's a wholesale price. That doesn't include the cost of delivering it to your home or business and all the other things that go along with the 23 or so riders we heard about a few minutes ago. About comparisons over time, that's a little bit more difficult because, again, you try to compare our rates to Iowa or the Dakotas, and it's apples to oranges again because the mix of industries aren't the same. But in my looking at this over the years, about 10 years ago, we were fairly competitive with the rates being charged. Customers in Iowa and the Dakotas, they were the lowest in the region. Now we're not as competitive with them. They're charging in the 5 cent range, maybe under 6 cents. But we're still under what they're being charged in Wisconsin and Michigan, for example. So we're maybe not as competitive as we were with the lowest cost states in our region. We're still doing better than the higher cost states in the region. But the point, I think, was made the last go around. We're not just competing in the Midwest or in the United States, but with rates all over the world. And with the exception of France, we're very competitive in this country on electricity prices against Europe. There are places I'm sure you could find in Asia and some other locations where perhaps we aren't as competitive on just purely rates. So hopefully that answered at least one of the questions or two of the questions that came up. Again, to follow up on the first speaker, trying to explain the subtleties about the kilowatt-hour charges. So a lot of these 23 or so riders or whatever the number is are trying to track a whole bunch of different costs. And as much as expediency reasons as anything, they calculate everything on a per kilowatt-hour charge. But a lot of the costs that are being recovered are being driven by peak demands. And so if you're an industrial customer who has a round-the-clock, seven-day-a-week operation, you use a lot of energy hour in and hour out. Maybe you're not so you're not imposing as much on the system during the peak times as I would as a residential customer who would come home at 6 o'clock and turn on all my lights and my air conditioning in the summer. So even though the two different types of customers might be paying the same price, the cost drivers are very different. So if you have underlying costs that are more demand-driven, that are more peak load-driven, it's unfair then to industrial customers to charge everyone on an energy basis, a per kilowatt-hour basis. So I hope that gives you a little bit of flavor of the complaint that the industrials have when they talk about how the rate design is done on the riders and the surcharges, because they feel like they're paying, compared to how they drive costs on the system, a disproportionate share of these riders and some of the other surcharges. So hopefully that covered some of the questions that came up with the earlier witness. But I did want to give a little bit of a flavor for a couple of the mandates and how complex and hard to tease out yes or no answers to a lot of these questions can be. And so I had the handout, which I understood everybody got a copy of, to talk about two things, and I know you're going to have SIP Day, but I still wanted to do this, the Renewable Energy Standard and the SIP. And so I want to, perhaps you'll be surprised, but there really is nobody at the state level who's tracking rate impact on customers from the Renewable Energy Standard. You know, it all gets rolled into fuel adjustment clauses and demand charges and energy charges that customers see on their bills, but there aren't separate line items by and large for that. and it's hard to tease out what wind is costing versus what coal or nuclear is costing, except on the most gross aggregate levels. So when you're trying to ask a very simple, straightforward question, what is the renewable energy standard costing ratepayers, there is no simple answer. Like, I'd like to be able to say it's a cent a kilowatt hour or 2% more than they would otherwise charge. We had a very interesting presentation from Mr. Rolfe of Medtronic where he tried to throw out some numbers, and, you know, his guess is as good as anybody's at this point. So I would encourage, when you take a look at some of these mandates, you take a look at a process or set up a study. You know, believe it or not, I'm going to advocate another study be imposed on the state to pay for the what I think you'll find a very useful and hopefully a good return on the investment, a very rigorous, thorough, analytical look at these mandates and trying to tease out what they're imposing on the ratepayer over and above everything else that's going on and all the noise that goes into creating rates. And so when you'll hear stuff like John Rolfe talk about, he thought it was adding a 10% increase in his rates. You know, unless you're Minkota Power, have some special situation that's fairly unique, probably not that much. Just by my back of the envelope guesses that I've done with some of the data that I've seen, you know, maybe it's more 1-3% in that range. But that being said, you also hear people on the other side saying, oh, well, it's the cheapest resource there is. Well, and that's why I wrote in my little handout here, well, where are they coming from this? And often the answer when you ask, okay, well, where did you come up with that is, well, it's our model. You know, the modeling we do in the integrated resource plan does a lot of useful and interesting things, but it really isn't designed to answer the question of ratepayer impact. It's designed to optimize an entire portfolio across a number of resources and a long stretch of time. So, and some of the costs, for example, that we don't typically model when we're looking at wind include like the system integration costs, some of the take-or-pay payments you've heard about over time, the negative LMP payments we heard about from one of the witnesses at the last hearing, the hit you take when you turn down a coal plant or turn down a nuclear plant to accommodate more wind on the system. But on the other side, when we're looking at coal plants, you know, on the wind side, there's some hard dollar costs that get passed on the ratepayers that we don't always model in our modeling efforts. But we do model some what I would call soft costs, costs that won't actually be imposed on ratepayers when we're modeling coal plants. That includes carbon costs. We impute a cost for carbon, even though there's not a cap and trade system, certainly not in the Midwest. There doesn't seem to be a prospect for one in the near future. We also have a health externality that we impose upon coal plants and fossil fuel plants to recognize the negative externalities that they impose on society. Those aren't costs that a ratepayer would be asked to pay at some point in the future, but those are costs we impute in trying to do the I've heard it described as apples to fence post comparisons between resources. And I'm sure proponents of renewable energy could come up with great counterexamples to go against the ones I just said, where we don't include some fossil fuel-related costs, but do impose some cost on wind and solar or whatever. But just keep in mind that it's not just a simple matter of, well, I ran the model and got this result. There's a lot of assumptions that go into these models, and they're not designed to answer the exact question that you're asking is, what is the impact on ratepayers? That's going to require, I'm afraid, a separate effort that just dedicated to looking at that. And the other thing that about the modeling is we go through this exercise, which is useful and necessary to do the resource planning, but then we don't go and circle back. Okay, we've decided that this was the lowest cost resource, but then we don't go back 10 years down the road saying, well, did the ratepayers get the benefit of the bargain for that? You know, that effort on passing costs through to ratepayers is a whole separate item, and there isn't that direct link back to the resource planning, that feedback loop, if you will. So, again, but we do have efforts we've done over time to try to make these inherently difficult comparisons between different types of resources, intermittent resources like solar and wind, dispatchable resources like coal and natural gas, energy efficiency. they're very difficult to try to compare these. That's the use of modeling, because you can try to optimize a whole system, but trying to say, okay, energy efficiency costs this and coal cost this, so therefore we should do one and not the other. The real answer is yes, we should do it all. And that's probably the bottom line message I want to leave with you this afternoon. But I know you're going to do a SIP day, but I did want to talk a little bit about SIP and how we define it, because at the last meeting we had the observation made that SIP is, by statute, has to be cost-effective to be implemented by utilities. And that's absolutely true, that we have in statute and in rule the requirement that utilities have to show that their projects are cost-effective in order for them to be included in their SIP program and for them to recover those costs from ratepayers. But again, as like a lot of life, the devil's in the details. And I commend to you the very last line on my sheet here is a link to a study that's at the Environmental Protection Agency's website, where they looked at some other studies that were done and put together. It's 96 pages, but trust me, it's well-written, easy to read, primer on conservation, utility-run programs, and how you define cost-effectiveness. So if you have an interest in the topic or your staff or your researchers want to learn more about this, I would suggest they start with that very useful primer on the EPA's website. And basically there are five different ways we look at cost-effectiveness, really five different perspectives from which we looked at cost-effectiveness. Participant, that is somebody who's getting one of these rebates and putting up their own capital to supplement what they're getting from the utility. The utility itself, you know, how does this resource of energy efficiency compare to something on the supply side? The ratepayer impact, if you're not a participant, you're Medtronic or Bushel Boy or somebody else, you know, how does this impact your rates? Looking at a total resource, which I won't get into that, how that's defined, but the societal standpoint, you know, for society as a whole, is it better off that this set of economic actors are engaging in this activity or not? But a couple of quick points I wanted to make on this was that each test looks at the issue from a different perspective. Who, what role are you playing in this drama? And each uses a different discount rate. That is, you spend money on a conservation measure now, putting in new lights in an office building, and then you put up money up front, but you realize that savings over a number of years, you know, the 10-year life of the equipment. And so you need to discount those cash flows back to present to see if it was a good upfront investment. And we use different discount rates to do that. We use, for participants, we'll use a rate that's supposed to represent what a consumer can borrow money at. And for the utility, what their weighted cost of capital is at when you blend in the cost of issuing stock with issuing debt. And for societal, we use something that looks like the long-term government bond rate, or 5%. And so a couple of interesting observations. In Minnesota, when we talk about cost effectiveness, we look at the societal test, which uses the lowest discount rate. And I think this ties back to what the witness from Medtronic was talking about. When he goes to his bosses trying to get them to spend some of their scarce capital on an energy efficiency project, he has to compete against every other use of that capital inside the company. So back to the little discussion that you, Madam Chair, we're having with Senator Rosen a few minutes, or sorry, Senator Anderson a few minutes ago. You were both right that utility customers, large customers, have every incentive in the world to be as energy efficient as they can. They frequently, as we heard from Medtronic, spend their own money, their own capital on these programs, even if they can't get some recovery from the utilities, because they have a bottom line interest to do so. But Senator Anderson was right in that a lot of folks can't justify spending capital on something that has a 5% return. They've got to show 15 or 20% return to win the sweepstakes for scarce capital in a corporate capital budgeting exercise. So, you know, and when we look at it here, we have to think about, well, what are we talking about when we're talking about cost effectiveness? Because we're not always talking about the same thing. A corporate customer might think, if I can't earn a 20% return on my investment, I'm not going to do it. But society might decide, well, we're better off by making this investment because it's still all told better than our alternative investment. Again, from each perspective, there are some things we don't include in cost. And one of my bugaboos is when we're talking about what we're spending on conservation, we talk about the rebates to customers. We don't include the administration costs, the overhead costs, the utility financial incentives, which could run up to millions of dollars. And so I think we may all benefit by having a very clear-eyed view of what it is we're talking about, having good data in front of us that captures all the cost. We may well decide this is all good investment. We may well decide that we're better off having mandates or mandates of the type, but we should be making sure that we have all the accurate and full set of data in front of us when we're making that decision, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Mr. Pagel. Hi, Mr. Pagel.
Madam
Chair. Good to
see you. Thank you for letting me testify today. I appreciate it. It's always good to be in front of this committee. I've worked with many of you over the years. But today I represent the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. It's made up of the six taconite mines up in northeastern Minnesota. And I'm going to give you a little background because we're talking about how energy and jobs are related. But I'm going to talk about it from a little different direction than what you've been hearing about, except for the last couple of speakers. I think they've done a nice job. Iron mining in northeastern Minnesota has the six taconite mines that we have right now. There's a new nugget facility that was built during the recession that employed construction workers. A scram mining operation was built during the recession. Scram mining is where you take existing overburden and that places that have trace mountains of iron, and they found ways of pulling out that iron different than present technology. And there's also a mine being built at this time that will take iron ore and take it directly to steel once their full project is done. The Iron Mining Association is also made up of 175 businesses that supply the products and services to the mines. Because we're fairly large, I had a study done with other people, including Iron Range Resources, University of Minnesota, and others. And the University of Minnesota Lablet School of Economics did a study based on 2007 numbers. The report was done in about 2009. So what I'm going to talk about for the next couple minutes is based on that on their report. Iron mining helped contribute $3.1 billion annually to the gross regional product of northeastern Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin. The six mines paid over $148 million in state and local taxes. And that's in 2008 based on 2007 production. And happy to say that our production is back up around those figures right now after the recession. Of that, $46 million went to K-12 education, $11 million went to the University Trust Fund. That's the trust fund that the University of Minnesota scholarships come from. Mining is the single largest contributor to the region's economy of northeastern Minnesota. It's responsible for 34% of the gross regional product. And that's going to jump in the years to come. Every existing iron ore mine creates another 1.8 jobs in the communities and in your communities. It reaches through the whole state. We purchase goods and services from other industries, including electric and gas utilities, transportation, and manufacturing. We're the front end of all manufacturing. Every piece of equipment probably needs steel in it if you're going to be running some sort of manufacturing. Or as the mining industry likes to say, if it wasn't grown, it probably had to be mined. And even if you're growing it, you're going to need some steel to, you know, for that plow or whatever the case may be. On energy purchases make up 25% of the cost of taconite mining. 25%. I don't think there's any other business in the state that has quite that high of an energy cost. Of that, if you look at just contracts, electricity alone, if you take out the cost, other costs such as employees, taxes, and you get to just the business, the other services that you buy or contract for, makes up, electricity alone makes up 30% of those contracts. So energy is a huge part of mining in northeastern Minnesota. Expansions and new projects that we're looking at, and I'm only going to be talking about iron mining now. We've heard a lot about copper-nickel mining. I'm just going to be talking about iron mining. The expansion of the iron ore operations and the development of new projects will have the potential to generate an additional $2.9 billion, increasing jobs, 3,442 new jobs. That doesn't include the construction jobs. construction jobs will probably have, at any one time, depending what gets built at the same time, if they're on top of each other, between 1,000 and 6,000 jobs. Last year, 700 new employees were hired in the mines. And a lot of those were based because there's going to be people retiring, and we want to make sure that we have really well-educated, smart, highly technical people working in the mines. Next year, there's a plan to hire another 200 people, and this is just in the existing mines that are operating at this point. The other day, we met with the new DNR commissioner, and in part of my spiel in the study that we had from the Labowitz School of Economics, the average salary, including benefits, was $65,000. And when I said that in the meeting with the general managers, they all gasped and said, no, it's not. It's almost $100,000. These are very good paying jobs. Not only are there these jobs, but the jobs of all the other, in other words, for every one mining job, you almost have two other jobs. They're usually quite technical as well. They go from the engineering firms, but it also includes the small companies that might sell everything from logos to some of the large equipment that some of you saw when you were on the tour this last week. So we do have quite an impact, and energy is a large impact on us. The economic impact of the new construction that I talked about, now this is just construction costs, not the $3 billion that we have that's just operating on an annual basis. It's $5.2 billion in construction. We hear that a lot of construction workers are not back at work. We're trying to put them back to work. Let's see. So far, you've heard basically from people, at least in the hearing that we had, I think it was last week that was here, about the people and how you should, their type of brand of energy production. So far, a lot of the talk has been about the generation, and it seems to be that the motto is, we'll build it and we'll make the customer pay for it. And I think that there needs to be a little more input, and some of the last speakers talked about it, on what those costs are. In fact, generation has to match the customer's demand at any given time. It's not the other way around. You hear about the generation pool, and it's literally like a pool, like a kid's pool that has hoses going out from it. Those would be the transmission lines and lines going. That energy has to be, or water in the pool, has to be there, and it doesn't move until the customer turns on a piece of equipment and it flows towards the customer. It's just the rule of physics. You do not, and I'll repeat, you do not generate electricity and push it to the customer. It's being drawn to the customer. So the generation has to meet the demands of the customer and not the other way around. And it's very important that that type of generation matches each of the customer's needs because they are different. Large industry, as you've heard, uses quite a bit of power. We're the largest single energy producer, and we run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with the load factors well into the 90s, if not the upper 90s. And most of all, we compete in a global market. We cannot just pass our costs on as they increase to our customers. We have to be able to compete with China in their production of steel, iron ore that they're getting from Brazil, iron ore they're getting from Australia. As an example of how much energy is used, one of the mines up on the range, if you take out just one customer out of the whole city of Duluth and all of its industry, and that's a large customer, to take out the paper mill that's there, the whole city of Duluth has the same demand as one customer, one large taconite facility. Their energy use is probably actually higher because they run 24 hours a day. In another mine, some of the people that were on the tour were told about a piece of equipment that has 2 6,000 horsepower motors on each end of it. There's 9 of those. That's about 10 megawatts apiece. So they have about 90 megawatts just in the one plant just to run one type of equipment. That's more than most of the small towns you come from. So I guess what I'm trying to say is we really watch what our energy use is, down to the cost of price per ton on each ton that comes out of the mine. We need more say in what the type of energy policy is developed and the way the rates are set Recently, Minnesota Power had a rate increase that they proposed about a 10% to 12% rate increase across the board. Public Utilities came back and put all of the rate increase, or most of the rate increase, onto the large industry customers to the tune of about 14%. When you have an energy bill that's somewhere around $1 million to $5 million a month, that's a heck of a hit to take in 1 year.
Mr. Pagel,
sir,
is the industry concerned about where their baseload needs are right now and how the energy direction in the state is? Are they going to be, that the state's going to be able to match what the iron mining industry is going to need in the future?
In the present future, from my conversations with Minnesota Power, who is the provider of that, we make up 34% of their whole revenue and their generation. They are looking at some long-term contracts for baseload electric outside of the state of Minnesota. And I have to give them credit that they are looking at hydro and wind and combining it. As you know, when wind goes down, you need to bring up another generation source very quickly, usually within 15 minutes. Hydro can do that. However, right now we don't include hydro on the scale as one of the renewable resources. So we will still see Minnesota Power trying to get more renewable resources to match the goal, and people will be paying for that, though our need is not for that type of energy.
Senator Metzen.
Where would you look for, I mean, that, Madam Chair, that hydro plant you have now is very small.
Yes.
I mean, that couldn't make up, what, 2% of your power, so you must have other places in mind for hydro. I've been to the hydro plant up there, and it's nice, but it's not much.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, you are correct. It would have to come out of Manitoba.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions?
Thank you,
Mr.
Pagel.
Appreciate
it.
Very nice of you to come up. Mrs. Seifert. Ms. Seifert. Welcome, Ms. Seifert.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm actually Bride Seifert. I'm
Seifert.
Married one. That's okay. And as you know, you've heard before, I'm the Energy Policy Manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And you just heard this last week, too, but it's worth saying again. We have over 2,300 members, and that represents 500,000 jobs in Minnesota. So I'd like to just share with you some thoughts, what we hear from our members, and some concerns about how Minnesota's energy policy actually drives business here. So over the last two hearings, we've heard really good success stories. Solar projects, greater conservation, and like John Rolfe said, that conservation is something we can all get behind. Trying to avoid another generation plant saves everybody money. It benefits all the ratepayers. The SIP program actually funds Energy Smart, and that partners with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. So there's a lot of success stories here, and I think on SIP Day you'll hear some of those. But some other success stories, and you've heard, I guess one of the things you've heard over and over today, and you'll hear from me again, is about costs. And currently in the integrated resource plans, the utilities are meeting their renewable energy standard objectives, at least for the next couple years. But we simply don't know the cost, and a lot of folks talked on that again, but it's worth saying over, because if a cost-benefit analysis is done, you know, we'll fight about what goes into the cost-benefit analysis then, but at least we'll have a good starting point for trying to figure out what our costs are, what our benefits are. And when you talk about green jobs and the green economy, I just want everyone to know that the green economy is part of the whole economy. So it's not all just success stories. There's been plant closures, Sioux Lawn closed, 110 jobs lost, a North Dakota wind manufacturer just closed, 150 layoffs. Faribault, I just read, doesn't expect to get a turbine manufacturer, Moventus, online this year. It was slated to come on in 2009. Just in
Seifert. I just assumed you were related to Marty Seifert. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Oh no, everybody does. I actually talked to him last week and said, I wish he goes, just tell them we're all fifth cousins, because that's probably the truth.
Ms. Seifert, what about why on that Faribault plant?
All I did was read a little blurb in the Department of Economic Development. It didn't say anything. It just said it was slated to go online in 2009. As of now, they're not expecting it to come online this year. I can find out more for you if you'd like. And then just earlier this January, Mortenson put out a report called Facing the Wind, where the president of Mortenson, who works heavily with the industry, called the future of the wind industry challenging and uncertain. And the president of the Minneapolis-based National Wind agreed with him. So I just want to put it in perspective. Everybody's hurting. Even these industries where there is a mandate that they have to have 25 by 25. So the Minnesota Chamber supports green jobs, but we just want to make sure that we're supporting all the different colored jobs and that we don't support green jobs at a disincentive to other industries that are out there, whether that's in higher utility rates and lower profit, or a message to business that says we don't really want you to expand or locate here. And so solar, same thing, great successes, but a lot of the ones that I've read about have incentive on incentive after them, whether it's grant monies or federal tax incentives. So they are successes, and we want them to continue being able to succeed. But our hope is that it'll be more on their own than with the number of incentives piled up. So make no mistake, something like green jobs, they are successes. But it's not, this free market miracle. This is a direct result of our policy in the state. Another thing I just want to touch on is what we call, and it's, again, been talked about today already, is costs and pricing. When we're at the PUC trying to figure out rates and what we're going to argue about, one of the things that we look at is cost of SIP and RES, and it is very difficult to determine. Some are in riders, and then they move into rate base, and then it's hard to see them. Some are hidden in a fuel clause adjustment. If a utility doesn't own the actual generation, it'll be passed through in a fuel clause. And SIP isn't just its own item, line item. And you add that's just for one utility. Every utility in the state bills differently. So even folks that are paying attention and trying to figure out, hey, what's this adding up to? It's not an easy process. So I don't usually like tons of studies either, but I agree with Mr. Glahn that there's got to be some type of cost-benefit analysis done, because the utilities aren't required to tell us how much these things cost. When the 2007 Next Gen Act went into effect, there wasn't a cost-benefit analysis. And every couple of years, the utilities have to give us reports on if they're meeting their RES and how they're doing on that. But even in those, it doesn't say, hey, what's the cost? So that's something that we talk about and that we care about, and our users, our members, would like to see more of. And we're not saying what that's going to show. It might say that, some utilities say that wind is the least cost, and others say they're just getting killed on it. So, it's across the board, depends on the utility, depends on the generation. But what we do know, and Senator Metzen talked about this, and so did Mr. Glahn, is that in seven states that include Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and the Dakotas, we've got the highest average commercial and industrial rates. Now, compared to the East Coast and the West Coast, we are still super peachy, and we'd like to keep it that way. But, we've sort of lost that big drive that brought people here, saying, hey, we're really inexpensive. And as Mr. Johnson said, 20-some years ago, it was actually how they decided to bring their business here. Another thing, and as far as those rate impacts and rate policy, there's a company called Viracon. They're also in Owatonna, and they've got 1,200 jobs down there. They produce a architectural glass product. They're very eco-friendly. What they produce actually helps companies when they're building have, less heat in the winter and less cold in the summer. So they're producing a very, very green product. And when I talked to a gentleman down there, he said, when we're looking to site and we're looking to expand, the cost of electricity and the policy that folks use for electricity are in the top three or four things that they consider. So it is something that people are looking at. The last thing I want to talk about as far as another thing you've heard about today is rate cases. Just to let you know, we're waiting an administrative law judge decision in one case. We just started hearings today. That's the IPL case. It's asking for a 22% increase. And we're doing discovery on a third. This is all right now. We were just denied a rehearing and request for reconsideration on the fourth. And that's the one that folks talked about, the Minnesota power rate case, where you heard that, you know, large industrials took a big brunt from that. But what you didn't hear is that the cost of service, when they did that study, said the residentials, it costs a lot more to provide for the residentials, and they should actually, just as far as, you know, who's costing more to provide right now in this rate case, they should have a very high increase, and the industrials, again, in this rate case, needed a low increase. But, again, it didn't matter. The PUC said, we're going to put it on the large users because in 1973, I think, but I'm not sure, there was a case in Minnesota where they said, well, businesses can just absorb and pass on those costs. And we are still using that rate case today to decide rates. And it's simply not the case that our businesses can just absorb and pass on. You heard it from Mr. Johnson, and you'll hear it from any person doing business in Minnesota. So the message that we send businesses is something that I want everyone to think about at around the table. I appreciate that everybody's, you know, here talking about it, but we've got moratoriums, we've got mandates, we've got no cost analysis, we've got the PUC saying businesses can just absorb these. So if I'm a business, that's something I'm going to be pretty frightened of if I'm thinking of expanding here or coming here. So that's just, please keep it in mind. We appreciate it. And let's get some cost measurements out there. Maybe as Senator Jungbauer suggested last week, it might prove that renewables are the cheapest way to go and that it makes the most sense for folks. But right now we don't know, and that's something that we should know. The other thing is we really believe at the Chamber, and a lot of our members have told us about this, is that to get the options on the table, get rid of the coal moratorium, get rid of the nuclear moratorium, and use the resources we have here, which are magnificent experts and professionals over at the PUC and the Office of Energy Security, along with the utilities, to sort of figure that mix out instead of us figuring it out for them. And I'm happy to take questions.
Ms. Seifert, we are going to have a hearing also, not only on SIP, but also in rate cases, and I think that's something we really need to look into. But you kind of answered the question I had, is the Chamber members, where is energy as far as their energy concerns, as far as some of their priorities? Is that right in the top? Is it part of the mix? Is it?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm biased because I'm the energy policy manager, so I think it's the number one deal. But I know that everyone's talking about budgets and taxes as well. So it is, and transportation and education and a lot of other topics. So it's part of the mix. But for the folks that are on our energy committee, they're all there, and there's a fair amount of them. They're there because energy is something that they either work in or affects their business directly.
Senator Magnus, I know Suzlon is in your district, and that plant closing was probably very traumatic for the Pipestone area. I read, and I just like to have your viewpoint, that it was a faulty manufacturing or product, basically.
Well,
no,
I think
confidence in the product.
Well, Senator Rosen, it's common knowledge that early on there were some quality issues out of the plant a few years ago. But as I would go talk to him, that's not the only issue that was affecting it. And I think the overwhelming issue came later on is just the lack of financing. When the Wall Street fiasco hit, some of the folks in Washington decided to reform the banking industry, and I think they over-reformed it. And it just basically put a screeching halt to the availability of funds. And that was the major problem in seeing that plant go down. You know, when they built that plant, as soon as they built it, the folks that were there left and took off to China. and they were going to build a plant four times as large. Now they're making the same boards as they are there in China. And they're doing pretty good. So it isn't just the, an issue with the quality of the blades. And that's a bit unique situation when you go into China to do business. But, for example, we, in this plant down in Pipestone, they made the blades and they made the cones that that you see at the top of the structures. But in China, that's not the way you do business. When you go in, when they do a factory in China, they make all the products there. They make the pedestals, they make the gears, they make everything there. And that's just the model of business that they do over there. So it's a little different in that scenario in there. But, yes, there was some quality issues early on. But in discussions with the company, it was the financing issues.
Because I know in Iowa there was some great expansion on wind
right,
production.
But, Madam Chair, and also in Iowa, you know, heard some discussion earlier this morning that, you know, Warren Buffett is a supporter of wind energy, and he happens to pretty much own the largest utility in Iowa. I think that has a little effect on how they go.
It's where
like,
they're built.
Senator Metzen, it's like selling biofuels in Brazil. You know, the Brazilian company government owns the yeah. petroleum industry. So if they want to use biofuels, by golly, they're going to use biofuels. Yeah. We're not quite to that point yet. So,
thank you, Senator Magnus. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testimony from Ms. Seifert.
Why, thank you, Senator.
And I do agree that one of the secrets to our success in the state has been the low cost of energy. That's been in large part because we've used relatively inexpensive coal for a long time. So it would be interesting as we continue to review this. I know we had a chart that showed us exactly how much our energy costs relative to the other states around us, and it's pretty low. And to Mr. Glahn's earlier testimony, it would be really interesting to take our best guess at, you know, where all of this will put us over time, if we will continue to remain cost competitive, because I think that's important to do for our state and its economy and our competitiveness. There's a lot of other reasons why we're very competitive as a state in the business realm. What I think would also be interesting is if we could dust off some of the work that I think DEED has done and DNR and Ag have done under the last administration to really kind of forecast what we anticipate and changes to our economy that are going to come about with climate change and how we're going to have to retool the agriculture industry, the forest products industry, the tourist industry, that sort of thing. That work has been done, and it'd be interesting to review that because I think we need to consider that in terms of our business climate as well.
I think that's information we'll get to the entire committee. That's a good suggestion, Senator Dibble. Senator Brown?
Yes, Madam Chair, Mrs. Seifert. I don't know if you have this information, but with especially for large energy consumers, I would be interested in finding out if there have been any studies in anticipation of lifting the nuclear moratorium, how cost-effective mini nuclear reactors would be for large energy consumers. They can be put in at a fraction of the cost of large nuclear facilities. And hearing some of these people talk about their energy expenses going up, I'd be interested in at least finding out how cost-effective mini nuclear reactors would be as an option.
Ms. Seifert.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I would love to get you that information, and I will try to. I did just hear that the Iowa legislature decided that they're going to have a study done on that exact same question. So, you know, it was just a random email that I got saying, hey, look, I was looking at it too. So I will try to find it and bring it back to the committee.
Okay, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Seifert. It's very nice.
So much.
Yeah, great. Members, we are visiting the MISO Center.
That'd be very interesting.
That should be. I'm looking forward to it. So there will be some directions and questions, or some information about parking and security that'll come on your email, and maybe you can just do some collaboration and drive together. Hopefully, it should be about an hour. The tour, and that's on Thursday. Any questions with that, Senator Magnus?
Madam Chair, I understood, at least I recall from the last visit there, there is some security issues. So
right.
Why you keep looking at me?
Senator Metzen's going to get in there. I don't know how you're going to get in. I'll vouch for you, Matt.
Senator Magnus, he's the godfather of energy. So.
Okay, I'll go with you then.
You kept staring at me when you're talking about security.
No further questions. The committee's adjourned.
I have to have a